Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Happy 4th of July. I hope you have some great plans in store. And we have some great bird watching conversation in store for you. We have a couple guests who are here pretty much every holiday with us, sometimes with Larry, sometimes with me. I'm very happy to welcome both Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. Bill Volkert is a wildlife educator and naturalist at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Noel Cutright is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and a passionate birder. Noel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Judith. It's always great to be with you guys.
Well, there's lots to talk about. And as we kind of discussed before the show, summer sometimes is considered a slow time of year for bird activity and bird watching. But there are a number of things that can be observed at this time of year if you're paying attention. Bill, do you want to give us a couple of things that people can keep their eyes open for?
Sure. To put it in perspective, I think most bird watchers and enthusiasts look at spring and fall when the migration's on. We've got things changing every couple of weeks as new birds are coming and going, and there's a real excitement and activity in the air. All those migrants, of course, have moved on, and we've got our summer residents here. And it does get quieter at this time of year for two main reasons. One, birds are intensively nesting, so they're busy with eggs or young at this point. They're more reclusive. And, of course, with the heat of summertime, activity is early in the morning before the sun really gets up high and the heat comes on. And you probably notice you're sleeping with the windows open, all that chatter just around sunrise and early in the morning. And, oh, by 9, 10 o'clock, things can oftentimes slow down on warmer days. But this is a great time to get out, to see the young as they're coming out. So on Horicon Marsh, we've got the ducks with their broods, the goslings. They're almost full grown at this point. We're starting to see other birds coming out with young, the terns now, and some of the other marsh birds and songbirds are coming out. And if you have a feeder going, there's always a chance to lure those birds to that convenient food where we can see the cardinals, the grosbeaks, indigo buntings, birds like this bringing their young to the feeders and convenient food. And to be able to see them at a stage in their life when we normally wouldn't.
And you mentioned the young. Noel, how easy is it actually, depending on the species of bird, how easy is it to tell the young from the parents? I mean, are some young and adolescents look pretty darn close to the adults, don't they?
Yes, they do. When they first come out of the nest, very often you can see actually some down feathers still sticking out, especially on their heads, or they may have short tails, especially, or they just don't fly too well for the first a few days, and species like robins will have a spotted breast, whereas the adults, of course, lose those spots. So for the first few days, once they have fledged, you can very often tell the youngsters, but pretty soon they're going to be full size and pretty hard to tell for the most part, even though some species have an immature plumage that they'll keep almost for maybe a year or almost a whole year. So it really depends on the species, how difficult it is to distinguish the young from the parent bird.
So physically, it can be difficult, but are there certain activities or interactions that we can watch for that we can tell that it's a parent with a younger bird?
Well, very often, just like our youngsters, they will beg when they're hungry. And this only may last for a day or two, again, with certain species. Others will beg for a couple of months. It kind of depends on, again, the species, the size of the bird, and so forth. One of the common calls we have here to your show is this screeching sound that we hear during the summertime coming from a tall tree or a woodlot. And that is very often identified as a young great horned owl that's been out of the nest for a few months, but it's still hoping for handouts. So the food association is very often the easiest to tell, where you'll see maybe some young robins or young eastern kingbirds or other species following their parents as they fly around, hoping to, as they learn, to find food for themselves and to handle everything on their own. They're still somewhat dependent on their parents for a few days.
And Bill, you mentioned feeders. Is there any extra care that needs to be taken with our feeders during, like, the hot, humid weather?
Yes, definitely. First of all, keep in mind that unlike winter, there's more than enough food out there, so birds may not visit the feeders as often or as aggressively just because there's just such a smorgasbord of opportunities out there in nature. But oftentimes it's convenient, quick place to stop in for something and bring the young. But with the warm, more humid temperatures, there's also a chance for spoilage of the food. So a little hygiene around that feeding area is very important. Don't overstock the food. You want to be able to change it often enough, especially if we get really damp, humid weather, chance for molds to build up in there. The bird droppings around the feeding station, the bacteria can build up and spread salmonella among birds. So we certainly intend to want to help those birds. We don't want to harm them. So be careful in changing that food often enough, even your hummingbird feeders. That stuff can spoil after a while out there in the sun. Flush it out, change it, put something fresh up there, and just keep a little watch on that.
One interesting story, Judith, about back on identifying young birds, and they can really fool you at times. For example, James Audubon, which I think everyone has heard of, one of our earliest ornithologists, thought that the young red-headed woodpecker, which does not have a red head when he first is roaming around, he has a brown head. He actually thought it was a different species.
Wow. I want to make sure that people know how they can get in on the conversation. We're talking with Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist at Horicon Marsh, and Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. It is a bird watching discussion today on the 4th of July, as we spend most of our holidays on the Larry Mueller Show, and we'd love to have you join in. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org. Dave Potraz is our on-air producer today, and he will make sure to get your calls and emails through to us. So please do join in. Now, you mentioned that following the nesting season, some birds will wander further out to seek more abundant food supplies, and that can lead to some unusual sightings in Wisconsin as they come from other places.
Boy.
What are some unusual sightings that we might be lucky enough to see?
Well, I got to spring this one on Bill yet, because I don't even know if he knows it yet. But if he looks out his office window toward the northwest, he might be able to see a new species that's never been seen, documented in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, the note
before.
Was on my office door when I walked in about 10 minutes ago. So the word is out. It's getting around quickly.
Yesterday, a Madison birder who travels between Madison to visit relatives in Oshkosh always stops by. On usually both trips, going to Oshkosh and traveling back to Madison, you'll stop around Horicon and do some birding. Well, yesterday he found a neotropical cormorant roosting or perched in a dead tree that's just out from Bill's building there at Horicon, the new international center. And he took notes and took some photographs, and it's a bird that we've been anticipating for a few years now because it is ranging a little farther north. This is a bird that is typically found along the Gulf Coast up into maybe Oklahoma and Kansas, but does move around some and go a little bit farther north, especially after the breeding season. Hmm. And we have the double-crested cormorant, which breeds in Wisconsin. It's quite common, been here for forever. But the neotropical is about 20% smaller, has a long tail. And I say we've been anticipating it, and now we have it. And if it is accepted, and I'm sure it will be because dozens of birders have already traveled to Horicon to see the bird. I went over yesterday with my son and three friends to see it and take photographs. This will be the 433rd official species that have been documented for the state of Wisconsin. So a pretty exciting discovery.
Wow. And so this is one bird, as far as we know. What are the chances that this is the one sighting that will happen, and then we won't see another one ever or for a long time?
Well, that depends a little what's happening with the bird populations. You know, and as Noel mentioned, if you go to the southern United States, around the Caribbean, even the northern portion of South America, the neotropical cormorant is extremely abundant, but we're a little far north and out of the range. And as Noel said, as the population increases, there's always a bigger chance of somebody straying further north. So it has a lot to do with the tendency to wander among the birds, the size of the population, which, of course, if there's more out there, is always the greater chance for some odd one to get way off track,
mm-hmm.
and oftentimes even the weather systems. So as we get some of these southerly winds and oftentimes even the hurricanes that come across the southern United States and these far outer winds that spiral around them may pick these birds up, and they figure they're just making good time, and eventually they may end up quite off course. And this is the fun about the bird watching. You just never know what's going to get thrown around out there and show up. And as we have more and more people who are watching and also better communication among people to share those sightings, we're getting a better feel for just what these birds are up to, and both the common normal trends of what birds are doing here as summer populations, and these oddballs, so to speak, that just get off course and end up where they don't belong, and you never know what will show up.
It's just like our early settlers. There were the so-called pioneers searching for new places to settle down. Birds do the same sort of thing as populations change, or they're reacting to changes either in climate or food sources or who knows what. They're always looking for new places to go, and we see range changes and range expansions. We have a number of species that are becoming more common in Wisconsin that are more common to the south, but also species that are more common to the north, like raven. Ravens are actually spreading southward in Wisconsin now and breeding, and we have other species that's spreading northward. So it takes these early pioneers to first investigate areas, and, of course, if there's enough pioneers, they'll hopefully, a male and a female will find each other, and they'll start breeding in the area.
Well, and it seems that with climate change, I mean, there's a general trend around the world that tropical diseases and insects are moving north. I'm guessing that will be a similar situation for tropical birds that find more and more hospitable climates and habitats further north than previously they would have experienced.
Well, you do have both that long-term trend of climate shift and also land use practices and changes in habitat, both reforestation and establishment of former habitats through good management and through a variety of different human uses, the alterations, I wouldn't say outright destruction of habitats always, but certainly alterations that put stresses on birds. And, of course, you also have to keep in mind, just because something odd shows up outside of its normal range isn't always an indication of a trend that they're all moving that way.
Right.
You could have an oddball that just shows up, and you may never see it again. But that's all what keeps it interesting.
Great. We do have some callers that are waiting to join the conversation, so let's go to Kathleen in Bailey's Harbor and see what she has to say. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello. Good morning. I had two questions. My first is that in Peninsula State Park, we had a confirmed sighting of a black-billed cuckoo, and I wondered if the gentleman could tell us a little bit more about the status of the black-billed cuckoo in Wisconsin. And then my second question was if they could review the rules about keeping feathers or not keeping feathers, and also if they know of a good website that would help us identify feathers.
Well, let me give a shot at it, and then Bill can chime in, too, on these. The black-billed cuckoo is a species, and we have two species of cuckoo that breed here in Wisconsin, the black-billed and the yellow-billed. Yellow-billed tend to be more common to the south. I just got back from Ohio, where there's yellow-billed cuckoos everywhere. And black-billeds are hard to find. It's kind of the way around here in Wisconsin, even though we can find yellow-billeds, especially in the southern third of the state. But black-billed and yellow-billed are both declining, the best we can tell, based upon breeding bird surveys that are done. So it's a species that will also react in years when there's a big caterpillar outbreak. They love caterpillars, and if you get a good crop of caterpillars in a particular year, it seems like the population definitely reacts to that sizable increase in prey items. But it's a species that's kind of hard to see. They'd move, even though they're pretty large birds with a long tail, they move pretty slowly and don't sing all that common, and a lot of people, I think, have a hard time even recognizing when they hear a cuckoo. So it's a species that escapes detection more often than not, but it's a great species that's part of our breeding avifauna. And as far as feathers go, it is illegal to keep the feathers of most of our species, I mean, of a starling or a house sparrow or a pigeon. There's no problems with keeping those because those are exotic species. But our native species, you're not allowed to possess a nest or an eggshell or a feather. And as far as identification of feathers, I mean, no one's going to have a problem with you keeping a feather until you show it to your kids or maybe try to identify what bird it came from. And there is a new book that just came out in the last few months devoted entirely to feathers. I have a copy of it, but I don't have it here with me at where I'm calling today, but and I'll see if I can find it during some downtime here and let you know what the name of the book
great.
Is. But it's an interesting, great one. There's also a collection, I believe, out of Puget Sound University that has a great feather collection online. And I'll see if I can find that also.
Great. Thanks for that call. And let's go to Francis in Random Lake next. Hi, Francis.
Good morning. My question concerns hummingbirds. I seem to have a dearth of them this year. Very early in the spring, I had two that were flitting around my spruce trees, but since then haven't seen anyone, none of them at all. I have lots of flowering trees and perennials, but I haven't seen any at all. Plus, I have a couple of feeders up. Is that something unusual this year?
Not unusual as far as the overall statewide trend for hummingbirds, but, you know, oftentimes you got a pair nesting in your backyard or you don't, and if you've got them nearby and they've found the feeders and find it convenient for them, you know, they can be a regular visitor. And we get calls periodically on a show like this where somebody may notice in their own backyard either the presence of certain birds that they haven't had before or, in your case, like with hummingbirds, had them every year, but I don't this year. And it's more of a trend of the local nesting population. So they do move around from year to year as you see, say, some adults die out and young ones establish new territories. I've got good activity at my feeders. I was talking to a friend of mine just the other day. He said it was just crazy. He had like 10 of them because now the first hatch is coming out with those young, and they're showing up along with the adults, and there's oftentimes territorial battles. So from one person's backyard to the next, that can change. What we're really looking for is more the long-term trend of the overall population across regions, states, and across the entire continent.
Noel, are hummingbirds able to be found all throughout Wisconsin, or what areas might they not be in?
A lot of people in the southern part of the state where, you know, there's a lot of intensive agriculture and development, we don't have as many natural habitats around as we used to, we kind of get frustrated because they'll go up north and they'll see a hummingbird feeder at the, you know, at their favorite bar or dining establishment or around their cabins, and they always hope to have hummingbirds here in the southern part of the state. But very often, about the only ones they can find are the ones during migration, and they aren't able to entice them to stay. But the ruby-throated hummingbird does breed probably in every county in Wisconsin. Mm. It's the only species we have that of hummingbird that does that. We get a few vagrants in the fall that are more western in nature that seem like they're cropping up more in Wisconsin than what they used to, but we have better guides to them, and I think people are feeding hummingbirds an awful lot. One thing that I think it's kind of interesting is that sunflower seed now is quite expensive, but you can still put out sugar water feeders for hummingbirds pretty cheaply. So, yes, they do breed in every county, but I think they're definitely more common in the northern, say, half to two-thirds of the state.
We are talking with Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist at Horicon Marsh International Education Center, and Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. If you have a question or a comment about bird watching, please give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. We are talking about bird watching today with Bill Volkert, Noel Cutright, our usual holiday guests, and glad to have them with us. I want to make sure that everyone knows that this is Civil War Week on Wisconsin Public Radio, and so there will be programming on both networks, and music, talk, everything you can imagine, relating to the 150th anniversary of the start of the U.S. Civil War. Tomorrow on this show, at 11, Larry will talk with the curator of the Badger Boys Northeast Wisconsin and the Civil War exhibit at the Neville Public Museum in Green Bay. That should be really interesting. And then tomorrow at 11:45, Larry will visit with the reference and outreach archivist from the Wisconsin Veterans Museum to find out about the role of Wisconsin's Native American tribes during the Civil War conflict. So two back-to-back segments that should be very interesting and very Wisconsin-focused. So we hope you'll join us for that. Back to bird watching now with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, and we have Bob in Madison with a question. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. I want to ask about declining kestrel populations. Is it due just to nest sites? It seems to be accelerating.
Well, there is a somewhat of a trend of declines in kestrels. I don't have the data right in front of me. I can take a look here, but I don't think it's alarming. I notice as I travel around the countryside on the telephone wires and so forth, I don't see perhaps as many as I did 20 years ago. In rural areas, the old barns oftentimes provided nest sites for them. They are a cavity nester, by the way. So access to some of the old barns where either that upper window or a couple of missing boards provided an area. Those worked well. The larger cavities within the trees, they certainly have to fight over those with other birds because there is a limited number in areas. Contamination of food has certainly affected a number of raptors. I don't know if that's been cited here in the upper Midwest as a major source of decline for kestrels. Like I say, I don't think it's alarming, but yeah, there has been somewhat of a slight downward trend, especially in the upper Midwest and the California areas, I recall.
Hmm. Noel, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I'll add a couple of thoughts. I guess I'm a little bit more alarmed than Bill might be, because I think it is a pretty much range-wide decline in kestrels, and there's quite a bit of concern among conservation birding organizations, and I also think the government are really starting to take note, trying to figure out why. And, you know, he asked the reason. That's one of the problems right now. I don't think we have a real good reason for the decline, but it's being noticed in breeding populations as well as some of the places where they watch migrating raptors. You know, my son just got back from New York, and I think some of the data from a number of our hawk watch locations shows a decline to be pretty significant, and it's a fairly recent decline, and again, we just don't understand it at all. So it really bears watching, and I think we may want to try to start thinking about trying to get more kestrel boxes up. They do nest in cavities, so you can put up a box that's made for them just like we do for bluebirds, and maybe try to assist them a little bit to maybe at least level off the decline, or maybe actually start increasing the number of kestrels that we produce here in Wisconsin.
That is one of the difficult things to determine, is that among our birds of prey, the hawks and falcons, which the kestrel actually is a small falcon, where we had the decline of eagles, ospreys, peregrine falcons because of DDT, we've seen a nice recovery. We've also seen a tremendous comeback of Cooper's hawk, and those birds seem to be doing fairly well. There are serious concerns, of course, for the California condors and lead in the diet. And kestrels, why is it that they're going down and others seem to be recovering? Yeah, they're feeding on different food sources than other within that family. But as Noel says, the first thing is to take a look at population trends. How are these birds doing? If we detect a decline, then the much harder one is, what is the cause and what can we do about it? Oh, by the way, I did find the reference on bird feathers. If anybody wants to get a piece of paper out, the book is called Bird Feathers, David Scott and Casey McFarland, Stackpole Books.
Great.
That's the publisher, 2010. And feather identification for almost 400 species North American birds.
Great. We will look that up and get it up on the Facebook page later.
Also online, you can go into the Feather Atlas. This is a site that's run by the Forensics Laboratory, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So I'm sure if you just do a web search on Feather Atlas, it has a whole bunch of pictures of the flight feathers of all the various groups, and you can search a particular species, or you can do scans or whatever you'd like to do. So it looks like a great resource.
Great. Thanks for both of those. And let's go to Judith in Milwaukee next. Hi, Judith.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guests if they could recommend any place that would be especially good for finding water birds to observe in the sort of general area between Toma and Viroqua. We're heading out there in a couple of days for a family vacation. And also sort of if there are any birds in that part of the state that we wouldn't normally encounter in southeastern Wisconsin, what those birds might be.
Well, you're getting into that driftless area in western Wisconsin. You do have that nice rolling hillside with the forested slopes and small creek bottoms and mixed farmland. So we've got forest birds that edge for birds right along where the fields and the forest meets. Nice place for a mix of things. We tend to find some birds out there that normally wouldn't occur in other places, little pockets of bobwhite quail. The red-headed woodpecker seems to be much more abundant in that area. And if you were to get a little bit further west toward the Mississippi River, there's a number of birds that actually extend their range further north along that Mississippi corridor that we normally don't see in Wisconsin. So obviously it's a well-known spot. Wyalusing Park is a hot spot for some of these southern songbirds that can be seen there. You mentioned water birds. Well, that's a well-drained area of Wisconsin. It's mostly rivers and creeks, not the wetlands and lakes. So I would say, again, if you can get toward the backwaters of the Mississippi, the lower Wisconsin, those larger water bodies are certainly much more productive. Otherwise, that area, I would spend my time around some of the backcountry roads and forested areas and see what you can find there among the forest birds.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. I don't think you're going to be really good with water birds until you really get in the floodplain of the Mississippi. It's just too well-drained areas, and we don't have these large wetland complexes like we do a little bit farther east.
But it's got a lot of other bonuses.
Right.
Great.
Take those binoculars along.
Have a good trip, Judith. We'll expect any reports on great sightings that you see. We had an email from Mary in Madison. She said that this spring she and a friend encountered an unusual goose while visiting Lake Kaganza. They later identified it on the Internet as an Egyptian goose. How common are these birds in Wisconsin?
Well, they show up fairly often, and they're escapees.
Oh, escapees,
yeah.
From?
Yeah, from... there are game breeders and people who keep those things in the small farmettes in rural areas. And, he didn't fly all the way from Egypt. Don't worry about that.
Nope.
So these are things that are being kept, I wouldn't say as a pet trade as such, but, people do keep them, as they say, under game farm permits occasionally or, just as something around the farmette. And they'll get out if the wings aren't clipped and not penned. These things will move around, and that's something always to keep in mind is that some of these exotics may show up out there. And a number of the field guides nowadays devote in the back pages a little section of exotic species, things that you just might want to keep your eyes open for that really don't belong here but are starting to show up more often.
But they might just happen to cross paths with at some point.
Yeah, because people move them around.
Yeah. All right. Well, Mary, that probably was your only Egyptian goose sighting out in the wild, at least. But thanks for emailing. And if you have a question, and especially if you have a picture of a bird that you would like to have help in identifying, if you email that to talk@wpr.org, Dave can forward that on to Neil, to Noel and Bill, and they can take a look at it and have a little better luck probably than just guessing from a description that you might be able to give. So you can email any pictures to talk@wpr.org. Dave Potraz will send that along to our bird experts. For now, let's go to Ivy in Evansville. Hi, Ivy.
Hi. I just wanted to put a plug in for two things, one of which is our Wisconsin hunting areas. I not only hunt, but I birdwatch, and in the one near Evansville, I've seen, I'm almost certain that harriers are nesting there, the kestrels nest there, sedge wrens, lots of common yellow throats, and snipe, I've seen those. And I did see a cuckoo last week, but black-billed cuckoo, and bobwhite quail. And it's just, although it's not the best habitat, there have been really neat, it does provide some habitat for a lot of birds. And these places I've heard called not our pristine Wisconsin sites like Devil's Lake and why do we support them, but they do provide a lot of habitat. And the second thing is there's a new program called Bird City, and Evansville is now a bird city, and it's promoting habitat in urban areas for birds. And my yard is really small and used to be just grass, and you were mentioning the ruby-throated hummingbird needing more habitat for nesting in southern Wisconsin. And since I planted natives and some non-natives that provide food for hummingbirds and other birds, I've always had a nesting bird around. She's here all summer. And also I get a lot of migrants. I have elderberry growing, and the Tennessee warblers were crazy about it. And in this little yard, I've seen so many warblers like Cape Mays and Wilsons, and that if more people developed their yards in that way in an urban area, it could be great wildlife habitat. So thanks.
Great. Thanks for that call, Ivy. Yep. And I know that Bill and Noel, you've talked about bird cities before. Can you give us a little background on what a community needs to do to become a bird city?
I'll let Noel handle it. He's more
familiar
with it.
Sure. The first thing you need to do is to contact the website, birdcitywisconsin.org. It's just a wonderful website that Carl Schwartz, who is a coordinator for Bird City, Wisconsin, has helped assemble. And all the information that you need to on how to apply can be found on this website. Or, you know, you can contact Carl Schwartz, of course. He's very available to help out. You can mail him. He has an office at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center on Brown Deer Road in Bayside. Or you can email me, and I can be sure to get in touch with him. But I'd recommend everybody, if they want to learn about Bird City, Wisconsin, we have about 20 of these now, and we have a new set of applicants that came in at the end of June that we'll be looking out to add more of these cities. And we know that we have another 20 or 30 municipalities, communities working on their applications also. And as Ivy mentioned, Evansville is one of the 20 or so bird communities that we have in the state right now. So go to Bird City, Wisconsin, all one word.
And is Wisconsin spelled out all the way?
Yes.
All the way? Okay.
.org. And you'll find the Bird City basics there on how to fill out an application and submit it. And you'll get an attractive road signs to put up to the entrance of your community and a flag and a plaque. And you can have celebrations. It really gets the city fathers involved, whether it's the city forester, planner, town government, mayor, whomever it might be. They really get involved. And we've seen some just great reactions from our communities who have decided to pursue this kind of status.
Well, and Ivy was mentioning that, you know, she has a small yard, but because, you know, you tend to look out at your yard and think, well, how much of a difference can this small area of land make? But if you, you know, pun intended, if you had a bird's eye view and you see your little yard and then your neighbor's little yard and then maybe another yard a couple houses down, I mean, there can be a nice habitat corridor that's created, and, you know, that can really be very hospitable for a variety of not just birds, but animals and insects as well.
It can definitely add up.
And as she mentioned, not only are everybody's yards important to birds, but our state properties, a variety of different kinds of state properties. She mentioned the Evansville Wildlife Hunting Area, which is an extremely good location for many of our species, not only during migration, but as she pointed out, an important location for breeding of many of our species.
And a quick comment to add to that, the recent State of the Bird report that came out for the United States, the focus was on public lands. And as we see greater intensification of use of private land, and because of those alterations, more challenges for some of our birds, we find that for the public lands that we have, that they really are very important for a number of different species as critical habitat and also supporting on these public lands, very large proportions of certain populations. And so we're starting to realize that with the changes in land uses, these public lands now are becoming increasingly important as areas that are intentionally managed as habitat for wildlife, and they're certainly responding.
Ivy also mentioned having a nice crop of warblers in her backyard, and there were a couple warblers we wanted to make sure we mentioned. The federally endangered Kirtland's warbler is again nesting in Wisconsin.
Yes, that's exciting news for us. And Kirtland's warbler, if people aren't familiar with it, is federally endangered, as you mentioned. There is a tiny population that traditionally has nested in the younger to barely middle-aged jack pine stands in the northern part of the southern peninsula of Michigan. And back about 20, 25 years ago, the population had dropped to less than 300 singing males. And, of course, we always look at the males because we can detect them when they're on territory. And a tremendous effort was put in place at that time to try to remove cowbirds, which are parasitic nesters, which obviously was holding the population down. They were raising cowbirds and not their own young. And the intentional management and very intensive management of 5 to 15-year-old jack pine stands that are preferred habitat. They've also been looking at the wintering ground. These little birds go to a few of the islands in the Bahamas and spend a winter there, and with resort development and changes there, loss of some of that brushy habitat, the birds are a bit challenged. But they've really done quite a job. The population has come back tremendously and has done so well, we're getting a spillover effect. They have now essentially saturated that part of Michigan, and they're moving into Wisconsin jack pine stands. About 4 or 5 years ago, we started seeing birds on territory with the first indication of nesting attempts. And over the previous years, we had a few sightings here and there through the late 80s and 90s of a stray showing up. But now we've got about 20 males. They're back again, I think, 3 years in a row that we've had them consistently in central Wisconsin and also over to the northeast. We're trying to keep those locations somewhat secret to keep it secure for these birds. And U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has hired some summer observers and field monitors to keep track of the birds. They've been capturing them, color marking them so we know who's who by the color bands, and taking a look at nesting success. And, yeah, it's been really quite exciting for us.
Yeah, as Bill mentioned, we're really seeing a great response to habitat management for these birds. Back in the 70s and 80s, the census for the singing males, which is a typical way that we census a species, was like 200 individuals, and that was it in the whole world.
Wow.
And with management of these jack pine plantations through fire and planting, the census this year was around 1,700. So, you know, it's quite a dramatic increase, and as that population's grown, they're, again, looking for these pioneers. They're looking for new places to go, and a few have found Adams County to their liking, and as Bill says, we're, you know, in double digits here now for the last couple of years, and they're breeding successfully in Adams County and with a few individuals exploring other locations in the state as possible locations also.
Mm-hmm. And this is a great example that if we can understand birds and what it is that is holding these populations down or causing the decline, if we make it important enough and if we really put the manpower and effort into it and even the financial resources, we can turn it around and we can save these species. We just have to be vigilant enough to know which ones are being challenged and are declining rapidly, and then determine just what is the cause and get a concerted effort anywhere between the wintering grounds, the nesting sites, and in between to provide critical habitat. They can respond. We can help them, but we have to keep a close watch, and we have to make it a priority for us to make sure we don't lose them.
Well, and speaking of species that may be at risk, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recently announced that the golden-winged warbler may warrant protection under the Endangered Species Act. What has to happen to trigger that designation?
You have to have a percentage of decline of the population, and I think it's something like 90% decline of a population to show it is critically endangered. In other words, it is in danger of going extinct. The problem with some of those numbers is that a lot of birds, we don't have really old data. We don't know how many were here, what the population was like, say, 50, 100 years ago. So we start looking at them intensively as they're already being stressed and declining, and then we look from that benchmark to see an even further critical decline. And we have to provide reasonable evidence that it is warranted for listing. And the important thing of the Endangered Species Act is once it is declared as such, then by law, we have to make efforts to survey it. We have to put some money and resources up to really take a closer look, survey it, try to determine not only the short-term population trend, but the cause, and try to turn it around and get them off that list so they become a species of real focus. Through the North American and also Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, we're trying to complement that by essentially keeping common species common, and rather than just rescuing birds when they're getting to be critically endangered, trying to keep them from ever getting to that point in the first place. And so, you know, obviously, that little ounce of prevention is going to be really money better spent if we can keep them off the list and keep them from declining in the first place. Interesting thing about the golden-winged warbler is that between Minnesota and Wisconsin, well over half the entire world's population nests in those two states.
Wow.
Minnesota, the numbers off the top of my head, is something like 40-some percent of the world population, breeding population. Wisconsin, 25%. Noel can correct me on that one.
That's close.
Yeah, if my memory isn't exactly right. But we're really important here. And the bird winters in Central America in the higher elevations and into Colombia in this, believe it or not, in the tropics. It's a mixed pine-oak forest where we normally think of jungle in the lowlands. And the other important thing to keep in mind is when we talk about tropical deforestation is where you have these mountainous regions in Central and South America, the plant type communities vary a lot with altitude, from the real lowland mangroves and lowland rainforests going up to these higher elevations. And different of our birds, different species of our birds, winter in different habitats. And so there's different impacts on different elevations. So the lowlands is where they grow the pineapple and bananas. Higher up is the coffee. And that's really a big thing here for our golden-winged warbler. And you can do a shade-grown, sustainable coffee growing that provides winter habitat, or you can just clear-cut those hillsides, put it to sun coffee, And I spent time just 2 years ago back down in Nicaragua watching goldwing warblers down there. And it looked pretty desperate for them. There wasn't a lot of habitat among some of these intensively farmed areas for poor guys.
Darlene in Green Bay has a question. Let's go to her. Hi, Darlene.
Hello. This year, I thought I had a brand new bird, but I don't think so any longer. It is red like a male cardinal, sings and calls like a cardinal, but it has a black head with no crown. Do you have any idea what happened?
Missing feathers?
I don't know.
That's what I'm guessing.
It's been a while now. I would think that they would be growing back by now.
Unless you have an infection. Feather mites is common, or problems with the molt. And we do see birds occasionally that, they go bald, at least for a part of their life. So things like to live among those feathers. The feather mites is certainly one of the causes. And so with that, in the same way that dogs get fleas, birds get feather mites and other parasites, and they can damage the feathers itself. This time of year is not a big deal for them. They can regrow them if they can overcome that. Obviously, the feathers are important for insulation, and if they've got bald heads going into our winters, that can be critical.
All right, so they don't, like, interbreed with another bird or anything?
Mm-mm.
No. Yeah, and for some reason, cardinals are the ones that seem like they have more problems with losing their feathers. And, of course, with a red pigment, their skin is blackish. So without the red feathers there, their heads look very black.
Hmm. I have kind of a mangy cardinal that comes to my feeder all the time. And I recognize him because he's got some kind of gray discoloration in some of his feathers. And he just always looks like he had kind of a rough night when he shows up. So I kind of keep an eye out for him.
And if you look at birds close enough, you will see that there are birds that do have these little maladies and problems. And you know, if you look closely, you will see, you know, some of these things. In fact, there are a number of bird banders who specialize on bird parasites, internal and external, just to capture the bird long enough to see what are they infested with and what are things that either they may carry a parasite loading that may be an inconvenience or a real problem for them.
We are talking with Bill Volkert, who is a wildlife educator and naturalist at Horicon Marsh International Education Center, and Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. The topic is birds and bird watching. If you'd like to join in, please give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. So glad you could join us on the Ideas Network for this holiday bird watching discussion with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. And Bill and Noel, we have several people waiting to talk with you, so let's go right back to the phone. Jackie in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a longtime listener and supporter back in the days of, was it Sam Robinson? Is that the right name?
That I don't know.
Well, they would know. Anyhow, I'm trying to identify a bird. I don't have a computer. And the closest I have seen, this is one that was showing up, two of them, that were showing up in winter. And the closest I've seen on television was a bird that was belonged to a hawker. What do they call them? They use hawks for...
Falconer.
Falconer. Okay. Looked it as close. Anyhow, it's an unusual. They're unusual. They look like falcons. They have slate blue backs. No white feathers anywhere. Their breasts are like a peach or a buff color, and the two were different from each other only that one had a little bit lighter feathers around the collar, around the neck, and they flew like bullets, and I didn't get a camera that I could take a picture of until they disappeared after winter. But there were two, and they had long black tails that were square on the end, and the tail had black bars. If you could look at them real close, they used to sit on, one of them used to sit on my fence outside my back door. But I've never seen anything like that before. And I've lived here for 54 years, and I know the other birds, the hawks and the falcons.
Well, let's see what Bill and Noel think that might have been.
Take a look at a picture of a Cooper's hawk, just C-O-O-P-E-R apostrophe S. This is a species that's really increased in all of our urban areas and throughout Wisconsin. The populations were really depressed during the DDT era, but now they've really bounced back. And I tell people there's probably a pair of Cooper's hawks nesting in every park in Milwaukee County. So they've taken to urban environments quite nicely, and they love to feed around where bird feeders are located because their chief prey, for the most part, are birds. The adults do have this steel blue-gray back. They have very long tails, which helps them maneuver around houses and shrubbery and trees. And their breast is this kind of, as you design, peach color, kind of a bright brownish color. So I think you have Cooper's hawks. And they do breed, but of course, during, as Bill mentioned earlier, during the breeding season, they become a little more secretive. There's a lot more vegetation around during the winter time when all the leaves are off and they're searching for a sparrow or a mourning dove around a bird feeder. They're a little bit more conspicuous. So I think you have a Cooper's hawk or a pair of Cooper's hawks. The male and female, plumage-wise, are identical. The female will be a little bit larger than the male, as is true for most of the birds of prey. But as far as overall plumage, they're not different like a pair of cardinals would be. The male and female would have the same plumage.
And if they are nesting in the neighborhood, when the young are out, you'll notice they won't have that slate bluish gray back. It'll be more brown.
Right.
And rather than this fine barring of sort of that peach or copper color on the breast, it'll be brownish speckled. They won't get that adult color until they're, say, 1.5, 2 years old or so.
Oh, thank you.
There you go.
Well, that's pretty exciting, Jackie. I hope you get some pictures of that. We have an email from Ron. He says, our wrens have fledged. Do you recommend cleaning the house now or waiting a while?
You can clean that out if you'd like. They'll just rebuild, but they will use that a second time during that same season. There's still enough time for some of these songbirds to pull off a second brood, especially wrens with such a short incubation and rearing time. Some birds may only have a single brood of young. Sometimes the older birds are a little more experienced, get started a little sooner, and are able to build up the energy reserves and do a second clutch of eggs and raise a second bunch of young. So, yeah, you can certainly do that, clean things out if you like. They'll pack that back full again. Or you can wait just till the end of the season. The cleaning it now may help to reduce if you get some parasites like blowflies and things in the bottom of the nest.
Great. And we also had an email from Richard in Madison, a question about bird counting. He says, we hear a lot about bird populations and counts from a layman's perspective. I doubt you go into the forest and yell, yo, bird, sit still for the next hour while we count you. And given the rapid flitting around and the likely chance that two counters would count the same bird, what are the pluses and minuses for accuracy on these counts?
Well, they're all kind of indices. You're trying to compare changes from 1 year to the next. Most censuses don't try to get an absolute count in an area. And what we try to do, for example, the most common or the survey that's used the most to try to detect trends in populations is the so-called breeding bird survey, which are roadside counts set up. We have 92 of these routes. Each route has 50 stops, and a person stops every half mile along this route and counts everything that they can identify both by ear and by sight for 3 minutes and drive the road and stop a half mile and do it again. And these have been going on now for over 40 years, so it's a population that, or trends that we can detect when you do a lot of these all around the state and all around the United States and Canada to determine trends. But we also have specialized surveys. Through the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, for the last couple of years, we've been doing a specialized survey just for red-shouldered hawks. We've been doing owl surveys. We've been doing marsh bird surveys, where roadside counts don't do a very good job with rails and coot and gallinules. And so we have specialized surveys. And also, there's been a lot of concern shown by listeners to Larry's show over the last few years on whippoorwills. So we've designed a spatial survey just to start trying to get a better handle on whippoorwills populations by going out at nighttime and during the bright moons and doing surveys for whippoorwill. So a variety of surveys for a variety of species, and most of these are just indices trying to detect changes from year to year or from decade to decade.
So it's looking more at trends than actual numbers.
Right. Your caller actually raises a good point. Just because Knowles does his bird survey, steps out of the car and listens for 3 minutes, they're not going to call just because he's there. But if you make enough stops through good habitat and you do it year after year, you start to see, at least as you mentioned, the trend. And so we really don't talk about, say, there were X number of millions of birds 20 years ago and we're down to so many today. We don't know the total raw numbers. We're just taking a look at what we call a frequency of occurrence. In other words, as you do these surveys and you keep going over and over again, how often are those birds detected in those areas? And what is that trend, the rates that we're seeing a change in detection? Are they going up or are they going down, and at what rate? Now, there's a lot of biases in that because we're relying on a lot of professionals and amateurs, and not everybody knows all the calls. And you've got a little bit of problem there of who knows, what are the level of skill for the people, which birds are easier to detect, loud ones that sing very frequently, or those with soft voices. As Noel said, the marsh birds are hard to pick up on roadside surveys.
And I'm going to have to ask you to stop there, Bill. We're going to come up on a break, but we will definitely come back after the news and talk more about bird watching with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Thanks for spending your holiday here with us on the Ideas Network. Few things convey a sense of place, of time of day, and of season more than the comings and goings and calls of birds. But how closely do you watch them? Do you know where to look to see the young birds leaving the nest, or how to spot birds staking out their territory? Maybe you want to know how to attract them to your garden and yard. Our guests today are Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. They're with us until 12:30 today, and they can answer those questions and more when you call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, especially if you have a photo that you'd like some help in identifying. And don't forget to check out our Facebook page for updates and fun photos. Like it while you're there and get daily updates on upcoming show topics. I hope you'll stay tuned. There's a lot more, and we'll be right back after this look at the news. Thanks for spending your 4th of July holiday with us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today, and joined by Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. Bill is a wildlife educator and naturalist at Horicon Marsh International Education Center, and Noel is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and we are happy to spend this and many holidays with them talking about birds and bird watching. And I'm sorry I had to cut you a little short there, Bill, at towards the end, but we were talking about surveys and how those work. And Noel, I know you wanted to let people know about eBird as a way to enter sightings into a national database.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and let Bill complete his thoughts if you had any.
Well, as I was just saying, we never can do exact counts of birds just because they are elusive. And we're at least doing the best we can with how well we can detect the presence of birds and look for those population trends. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, the first thing is just to see how those populations are doing. If we detect declines, try to come up with some sort of conservation measures, figure out what the problems are, and try to reverse that. And, again, continue monitoring to see if it's helping, if things are coming back.
And, Noel, you wanted to talk about eBird?
Yes. eBird is a way for folks, whether they're backyard aficionados or really professional-type people, to go out and keep track of sightings online. It's called eBird, eBIRD, and the website is eBird.org. And Wisconsin has a portion of this nationwide website devoted to Wisconsin. So I would urge people to just go in and type in eBird and do a search, or go to eBird.org website and try to explore it and see all the kind of information. You can view and explore the data out there. You can see what others are being seen, what counties are submitting the most checklists in. They have a new data entry that was just released a very short time ago. And in fact, it also has a rarities photograph section. In fact, I just pulled it up here in front of me, and you can see a picture of the neotropical cormorant that's outside Bill's office here that was just taken yesterday. So
So again, that's ebird.org, and it's a crowdsourcing effort to track what birds are being seen where in the state and around the country.
Yeah, and people another data set for us.
Great. And we do have several callers who would like to join in, so let's go back to the phone. We have Dino in Madison next. Hi, Dino.
Hi there.
And what's your question?
I am enjoying some birds visiting my yard, but noticed that nobody takes a bath in the bird baths that I have. Is there anything I should be doing or looking for to help inspire them to use my bird baths?
Maybe some scented candles and bubble bath. No, no.
A little more romantic.
Yeah, a little more. Give them some privacy, Dino. Come on.
I don't have any special hints of why they may not be using it, Noel.
No, I don't either. They want shallow water, but all bird baths out there on the market are shallow, so that shouldn't be an issue. I actually use an old metal sledding disc perched on a couple of old rubber tires in the backyard for one of my bird baths, and I actually have a heated one that I use throughout the winter time out in front. And they kind of come and go. You don't see a lot of bird using them at certain times, especially when I have puddles in my driveway. I don't have a paved driveway. I just have a gravel, or my wife would say probably mud driveway that gets puddles, and they will use that. But other times, I'll have birds lined up in the backyard along an old rail fence, robins, bluebirds, sparrows, goldfinches, just lined up. I do put a rock in the middle of it. It kind of gives them a place to perch in addition to the sides. I don't know, it seems like they kind of like it, but keep fresh water in it and keep it clean, and really don't have any other advice, I guess.
Does it matter if it's in the sun or in the shade?
I don't think so. Mine are both. One of the things that really attract birds is dripping water, and there's several different ways you can rig up a bird bath that just has a drip feature to it. They, for whatever reason, they like running water, and dripping water will achieve that kind of running water sense, and it definitely attracts birds, especially during migration.
And I guess my suggestion would be just keep it out there and see what happens. As Noel mentioned, activity can come and go, so make it available, and if somebody comes by who's certainly looking for it, you never know what will drop in, and as things change a little bit from season to season. See what kind of activity you get there. Another thing to add for them.
Great. Thanks
also
for that.
Also got a quick update on the cormorant during your news break. I quick ran to the window. See, unfortunately, my phone line isn't big enough to get out of the office here. Did not see it, but there's about 8 or 10 people right out in front of the building with their scopes and binoculars. They're keeping watch on it, so... Yeah. After the program, we'll see if there's any sightings.
Great.
Well, I unfortunately did the other thing. I ran up to Wapund to look for merlins that are supposedly present in the residential area up there. Very unusual.
Wow.
So I missed the cormorants. But
lots of activity up there.
Did you find the merlin?
No, I only had 10 minutes. I drove up and down the streets again. I kept the windows open. I was listening and watching. I got some great photos from one of our local photographers again, so the bird is present.
Yeah, the merlin's a falcon that typically nest in the northern third of Wisconsin, but it seems like they're extending their nesting range a little bit farther south, and there's been a pair of merlin, as Bill mentions, in Wapund in a residential area now for a few weeks, and people are pretty excited to watch them this far south here in June-July period.
Well, and Bill, you also let me know before the show that there's confirmed the first ever successful nesting of bufflehead duck in Wisconsin at Horicon, too.
Yeah, this has been really exciting. In 2009, I watched a hen sitting in one of our wood duck boxes, again, right out in front of our building, and I suspected possible nesting. I didn't have time to really get out there because it's over water to get a canoe and take a look, and I figured, oh, we'll check and fall. Didn't realize the eggs are fairly similar in size and shape to wood duck, so one egg that was left over was indeterminate, at least from just physical characteristics, and I even sent it into UW-Milwaukee for DNA testing. It turned out it was a wood duck egg, but they tend to do what we call dump nesting, so it could have been another bird that laid its eggs there. We tried one of the egg membranes, what remains after they hatch. So we couldn't confirm it for sure, and it was a long effort to try to look at that 2009 nesting attempt as possibly the first confirmed record. Well, this year we saw bufflehead out there again, and back about, oh, I think 3 weeks ago, I asked one of my assistants, I said, hey, if you've got a few minutes, we're getting to the time of the hatch here, just get a canoe and take a look so we don't miss them again. he just went around and took a little digital camera, reached inside the box, and just clicked a few pictures shooting down just to see what was in each one. And one of them didn't look right. When he opened up the box, here was an unhatched egg. I think it was six hatched eggs and a dead chick. So unfortunately, one didn't make it out of the box, but we've got 100% proof. And in addition to that, when he looked at his images from another box, he had a hen on a nest, and he showed this during lunch, and I said, well, I thought it hatched. He goes, no, that's a different box. We actually have two of them now.
Wow.
So it's possible that one of the young even came back, and they commonly won't nest till their second year. And when I looked in the literature, one of our very early naturalists, Benjamin Goss, who did most of his work in Waukesha County, had a note with no date, no details, and said he found a hen with a brood of young buffleheads on Pewaukee Lake. Never been confirmed. We don't know if it's ever nested here. That's the closest we have is any anecdote about it. We have now confirmed for sure that we have buffleheads that have nested in Wisconsin, and we actually have two active nests, and so we'll be documenting that. The more you watch, you never know what's going to show up. And one of the things I find exciting about this time, this sort of era where we're in bird watching, is there's a lot of interested people. Millions of people own binoculars. And the really neat thing is that we're able to, through programs like this and internet, share sightings and get confirmation of photos and distribution. It used to be just a few professionals and avid amateurs who kept track of all these birds. Now we've got everybody watching and able to share that information. Mm-hmm. And we're learning things at a level of detail like never before.
And you also had black-necked stilts nesting on Horicon Marsh, too.
Again, this is really another bizarre bird, because if you look at the range map for black-necked stilts, they're in the western plains and into the intermountain area. And here, almost 1,000 miles away, we'll see them occasionally in Wisconsin as they get off course. But for the last 5 years, they've been coming to Horicon, and it looks like, again, their young may be returning. We've got three pair on the Horicon Marsh again, and a lot of birders have been going out there to enjoy them. Earlier in the spring, they were a little closer to the main dike road. Looks like they may have moved a little further into the marsh interior. But we've never had nest records in Wisconsin. For the last 5-6 years, we've been picking up records. They're all at Horicon, and these same few birds keep coming back and establish a little subcolony way away from where everybody else is.
It's an exciting time to be a bird watcher.
Yeah, you bet.
We have Judy in Minocqua who would like to join in. Let's go to Judy. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
I recently purchased a large tree, an evergreen tree, blue spruce, and it was transported down the road about 6 miles. When it arrived here, a little nest was in there with a baby robin that made the trip. Now, Mom was left 6 miles down the road, and I heard this little guy chirping and chirping away, and it was breaking my heart because I didn't know what I could do for it. Is there anything I could have done to make this little guy survive?
Noel, any suggestions?
Well, it really depends on you know, how old the bird was. There are a number of wildlife rehab folks around Wisconsin who will take a bird like this. It's orphaned. Obviously, being that far away, there's no way that you could hook up to them again, other than, you know, would have kind of been extreme. I guess you could have just taken the nest out and tried to find another blue spruce nearby where this tree came from and put it in a decent-looking location. And there's some likelihood that the parents would have found the nest with the young. So that would have been one kind of extreme measure to take, is actually try to move the nest back and put it in a nearby blue spruce where your tree came from, or to try to find a wildlife rehabber that would have fed the bird. They know what to use and so forth. You know, if the bird was getting fairly close to fledging, like maybe only a few days, you might have just actually been able to bring it inside and feed it enough earthworms and other invertebrates to allow it to the point where it could become self-sufficient. But if it was still really young, it's really difficult to do, and you have to have some training on how to be able to successfully feed and care for a real young bird. So I guess that's my initial thoughts, Judy.
Does the eyedropper method work? I remember when I was a little girl, my mother was giving a bird liquids with an eyedropper, but I didn't have an eyedropper here, of course, so I couldn't do that. But does that work?
I think it can for an issue, but you need to bring them on to more solid food as they get older. Just feeding out of eyedropper would be very difficult. And again, you need to know what to put in the eyedropper, I guess. Just something like sugar water would not suffice. You'd have to use some kind of probably a slurry or some kind of prepared mix that would provide them the nutrients that they would need to be able to grow and flourish.
Thanks for that call, Judy. Let's go on to Patricia in Madison. Hi, Patricia.
Good afternoon. Happy 4th of July.
To you, too.
I think I have a timely bird. Being Independence Day, this could have been our national bird if Benjamin Franklin had his way. So I know your guests there know what I'm talking
wild
about.
Turkey, right?
Wild turkey, right? Wild turkey, absolutely.
Yes. I live on a dead-end street in a residential area in Madison, and in the springtime, neighbors would say to each other, oh, did you see the turkey going across the lawn? And it would go across our lawns, oh, whoever would see it, like between 10 and 1 o'clock in the daytime. Then we didn't see it for a while. Well, at the very end of the cul-de-sac, it found a nice low area of daylilies, and it nested in there. And all you could see were its back feathers, you know, rounded up. And it stayed there so long, and we wondered actually if it was dead. Well, the neighbor whose yard is in said two weeks ago it was vacated, and yesterday I talked with another neighbor, and he said he saw the turkey at the end of our block with about 12 little ones.
Wow. Terrific.
Wow, success. Not unusual for ground nesting birds to have such large clutches. For our ducks, grouse, and the turkeys, turkeys will sometimes lay 10 to 15 eggs, but it's an all-or-nothing proposition for them, too. They are more vulnerable being on the ground, so if they do have a good season, they can raise a heck of a large family. And with the tremendous increase in our statewide turkey population, they're starting to show up in all kinds of places, aren't they?
Wow.
Yeah, and the incubation period is like 28 days, so you're talking about 4 weeks, so... Yeah, it's a long period that she has to sit on those eggs.
And avoided raccoons all that time, too.
Wow. Well, she was a good mom if they all made it to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Joyce in Prairie du Chien next. Hi, Joyce.
Yes. Are golden eagles larger or smaller than the bald?
They're close to the same size. Well, you will notice, however, the bill is much smaller. But the bald eagle, first of all, does have an immature stage, and a lot of people confuse, especially as they get into that second and third year with that mottling white through the wing feathers, confuse them with golden eagle. We do, and we are starting to see more golden eagles in Wisconsin in the western part of the state for wintertime. They are more out in the plains and up into the Arctic, so they're more of an open country bird. And the difference in the size of the feet and beak is for taking upland prey rather than fish that the bald eagle normally takes. So we do have some golden eagles in Wisconsin, but they are quite readily confused with the immature bald eagles, which don't get the white head and neck until they're, or head and tail until they're about, say, 4 or 5, maybe even 6 years old.
And Noel, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I think Bill adequately described the situation, and as he says, there is a lot of confusion because they'll just see a large bird that they are pretty sure that it's an eagle, and because they can't see any white head or white tail on it, they think it's a golden. But since it takes several years for that white head and white tail to develop, we have a lot, and with the number of bald eagles we have nesting in the state now, we have a lot of juvenile and second-year bird and even third-year bird, there are bald eagles flying around that people confuse for golden eagles.
And this brings up something that Noel mentioned at the very early part of the program when we talked about summer birds, is as you get to identify and know the adult birds, now's that time of year, and for birds that take several years to mature, to get to know some of the intricacies of those immature plumages, and for birds that take several years, like the eagles, to get to know them as second, third-year birds, and to make sure you're not always looking for just a white head and tail, for example, for an eagle. And so the more you know about them, the better we can now pick out those finer details of the immatures.
Great. Thanks for that call, Joyce. And let's go to Mary in Harshaw. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Well, my question is, we're snowbirds. We're out of here in the winter. And my husband says we're not going to start feeding the birds in the summer because then we'll have to stop because we're out of here in the winter. Can we still feed them and then
just bring in the feeders, or what do we do?
Sure. That's no problem at all. I think, you know, a few decades ago, people said, boy, don't, as you just said, and like your husband says, don't start feeding the birds, because once you feed them, you got to continue, and we're going to be gone for a period of time, and they'll all die. Well, I think we know now, and there's enough research and observations that there's many other sources of food that a bird will find. They won't become so dependent on a feeder, whether it's in the summertime or in the wintertime, that they're going to have hardships if that food is taken away. So I would go ahead and, you know, feed them. And right now it's kind of fun because you can see the parents bring some of your youngsters in. And it's just a different range of individuals and behaviors that you'll see around your bird feeder in the summertime than compared to winter's time. So, you know, go ahead and, you know, put out grape jelly, and you'll see a number of species coming in and using that you don't typically think of coming to bird feeders.
Well, and I also think that there are a lot of people that make a point of putting out feeders during the winter because they know that there are a lot fewer food sources available. So I think there will be people that will be making up for Mary in the winter that might not have feeders out now. So they're kind of, it's the changing of the guard maybe.
And there's also, just like Mary, you know, a lot of those birds are migrating south, so the ones you're feeding now are not the ones necessarily that be dependent in wintertime either. There's a small percentage of birds that don't migrate at all, and we can have year-round, but a lot of those are very seasonal visitors.
Chantel from Troy, Minnesota, had a similar question. She has a pair of rose-breasted grosbeaks that come to her feeder. If she stops summer feeding, is she going to endanger their food source?
No, that's not a convenience all for them. There's plenty of... right now, we're at the peak of food, really, in nature. All those insects that they're taking for themselves and their young for high protein, birds that are feeding on any of the seeds and other food source, there's plenty of it out there.
Great.
So this is more like fast food for them. It's just convenient. But it is fun because they can bring the young up to the feeder where you can actually watch them close up and enjoy them.
Well, I was going to say putting out feeders during the summer might be as much for us as it is for them, just so we can get a better look at things.
Yep. It's just convenience for them. It's for our enjoyment, you bet.
Great. All right. We have Kathy in Milwaukee next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I have a question about a baby robin. I've had him for over a week. What happened was there was a predator up in the nest. The nest was over 30 feet high. Even if we wanted to climb there, we weren't dumb enough to go that high. And this guy was tearing apart the nest and killing everything in it. So this one baby dropped to the ground. We took him inside. He's been living on cat food ever since. His eyes opened up. He's very, very perky. But my question is, what on earth do we do now? He's only been on cat food. He has no idea how to find worms, and he certainly is not afraid of us. Where do I go from here?
What do you guys think?
Do a slow release. Put that bird, you know, outside. Give a little bit of food there and let him search on his own. And that way there's always something secure to come back to if that's what he's used to. But hopefully he'll learn how to find food on his own. And I should make a little caution here. Like we mentioned earlier on feather collection, Noel said if you want to pick one up, hang on to it for a bit for close identification and recognition, nobody's going to say much, though federal law prohibits you from actually keeping and making a feather collection. Same thing with wild birds. We really, without proper licenses, should not be taking them into the house. I know people are well-intended, and sometimes it's the only thing that we find necessary to intervene. Again, I would assume, if I speak on behalf of most of our wardens, we understand your intention. You're trying to intervene to help the bird and get it out there, but let's make sure we only do that in emergency situations and even check with professionals to pick up those birds who have the training and permits. Again, they belong out in the wild. I understand your intentions, and, you know, again, nobody's going to arrest you for doing so, but the laws do prohibit making regular habits. I would do the slow release at this point. You have intervened. The bird didn't stand a chance, it sounds like. Get it outside. Have that food nearby. Let them feed on what he's used to, and let's see if he can't make his way on his own in the wild.
Noel, anything to add to that?
No, I think that's very wise advice, and you know, she should be complimented for being able to do this. And it takes time, and it seemed like the baby birds are always hungry, so I think she needs to be complimented for being a good surrogate mother here so far.
Yeah, the bird didn't stand any other chance.
Thanks for being a good Samaritan, Kathy. And actually, since you mentioned the bird topic again, there was a question asking to repeat the name of the bird feather book. And was it Bird Feathers by David Scott? Is that correct?
Scott and McFarland.
McFarland Stackpole Books, Stackpole, 2010. It came out late in the year.
Great.
Bird feathers, I think, a guide for Eastern species especially.
Great. Well, we have to leave it there. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, thanks always, as always, for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having us. It was fun.
Larry Mueller will be back tomorrow with two segments about the Civil War in Wisconsin. Thanks so much for listening.